Ride or die, but please die. In honor of Fate of the Furious, what's your favorite movie where the stars secretly or not so secretly hated each other?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with Mad Max Fury Road because Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy did not like each other very much, and it actually made the movie better.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I always liked the rumor that Tommy Lee Jones wouldn't socialize with Jim Carrey during the filming of Batman Forever. Just like a surly Tommy Lee Jones with purple makeup makes me laugh.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with Helen Hunt and the late Bill Paxton from the movie Twister, because they apparently did not like each other and would not appear in Twister the Ride. They had to film their parts separately, and this is something I learned on friend of the podcast, Film
Matt
Spotting
Singer.
SVU, Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore. Thank you for sharing that tidbit on your podcast, which I highly recommend to people.
Hi, I'm Joanna Robinson. I'm Jordan Hoffman. Excuse me. Hi, I'm Jordan Hoffman. And among other things, I'm the host of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. And I would be remiss if I didn't say Star Trek, because it's true. Everybody hated William Shatner. I mean, with varying degrees and over different times, they got along. They didn't get along. They got along again. They didn't get along again. And it's made going to conventions a lot of fun.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 162. It's Tuesday, April 11th, and on this day in 1961, Bob Dylan made his first appearance at Gertie's Folk City in Greenwich Village as a supporting act for John Lee Hooker. And I don't think that this bit of history was planned for Jordan Hoffman to nod his head sagely at, as I can see on
wow.
Skype. But Jordan, you're here for this. Hello, Jordan.
Yeah, that's swell. You know, Gertie's Folk City isn't there anymore, but the Cafe Wah is, and that was one of the first places he ever played, and some of those old McDougal Street, Bleecker Street places are still around, and they don't really have the vibe they used to, but you can pretend, and it's fun to go and have a coffee and listen to a folk singer. It's something you should do while you're young.
Well, and as right just before Bob Dylan took the stage, I assume Llewyn Davis was getting the shit kicked out of him in an alley somewhere.
Yeah, are any of these people the Gorfine son? That's what I'm really wondering.
Do you want to hear a quick inside Llewyn Davis story that I learned from?
We've got all the time in the world. Go ahead.
What else are we talking about? I learned this from the fella who played Mitch Gorfine. His name is Ethan Phillips, and he also plays Neelix. He was on Star Trek, so I know the guy pretty well. So I was talking, he was inside Louis. He's wonderful in that film, as he is in so many things. And I was talking to him about it once, and he said that when he got hired to do the gig to play the father, the surrogate father, Oscar Isaac had already been cast, but he wasn't really famous yet. He wasn't in Star Wars yet or anything. So to get in character, Oscar Isaac was going to Greenwich Village folk clubs and like doing open mic and singing and like just to get the vibe. And nobody knew this. And there are no tapes of this. There's no photographs. It's just he was doing this for a while. But when Ethan Phillips heard about this, he went down to one of the clubs to go listen. And Oscar Isaac had never met Ethan Phillips, didn't know what he looked like, didn't know who he was. So after the guy sang a few songs, he went down to the bar and Ethan Phillips went up to him and he said, "Hey, man, is your name Llewyn Davis?" And he kind of looked at him. He's like, "What's going on?" He goes, "Hey, I'm Mitch Gorfine. You know, I'm a professor up at Columbia University. You know, I think you're really great." And they sort of invented the backstory of how they met right there for an audience of zero. And they played out the whole scene and they created this little scene in their head. And that was that. And now you know this too. There you go. Actors, they're crazy, right?
Well, welcome to Fighting in the War. We brought Jordan back because David is away this evening and this week. And from what we've been reading in the reviews, the people want more Jordan. As long as we're not talking about politics, but we can't really promise that's not going to happen. So
It might come up, but I'm happy to be here. You know, I'm a very big fan. I listen to, I don't listen to any podcasts, but if I did, I would certainly listen to yours. I mean, you'd be the first one. So
speaking of reviews, I believe we have some this weekend. I don't know if any of them mentioned Jordan or not.
We do. Well, actually, the first one mentions Trump right off the bat. Trump's deregulation has allowed me to finally write a review, 5 stars from Wooden Lens. who writes, In my deep sleep this morning, I had a sudden rude awakening. I had a nightmare that the four wonderful voices forever hiding in my earbuds since the early Opkino days were suddenly MIA in Trump's dystopian American carnage. I thought to myself, if I lose these Sybil-like opinions on film in my life, then what would there be left to live for? Will I have done enough? What more could I have, or I could have done more. Why didn't I do more? Here's my 5 stars. May that row of yellow golden shapes get you inches closer to destroying any and all podcasts referring to billions and or dirty billionaires.
Wonderful. I appreciate all this.
Our second review comes from Facebook messaging, which has become a thing for our international reviewers as they realize we are really bad at checking international iTunes reviews. So here we go. First up, shout out and thanks to Matt from Alberta, Canada, your international reviewer from this week. Without Matt, I probably wouldn't have written this note. I always thought, what's the point? The reviews are always from America. What hope does someone from Melbourne, Australia have? Turns out, there is always hope. I'm a big fan of this show, though I'm not going to do a personal critique of each of you. You've all got your pros and, sure, a few cons, but very few. Instead, I listen for the encyclopedia of knowledge and passion you all exude when it comes to movies and TV shows. The little piece on Chinese film industry this week was a highlight that I wasn't expecting. Given China is almost a neighbor to Australia, almost is in quotes, it was nice to hear something that was almost, quote, locally, unquote, skewed. If I did have a gripe, it only comes off the back of this week. Fitwear needs a female voice. Three blokes, to use that word in the U.S., was a little much, in particular when talking about Raw and Prevenge. I know you were taking the piss out and being flippant, but too much men, too much mansplaining. Also, was it just me, or was there a random click throughout the show, like a Zippo lighter clicking on and off? Oh. No doubt I was still overthinking the ending of Big Little Lies and the policewoman with her poignant observations and lighter, but wanted to bring it up in case it was a sound mix issue. Keep up the good work, and looking forward to the delightful Katie Rich being back on deck.
Oh, hey! And I was going to make a Big Little Lies joke, and then you beat me to it. So I'm glad that we're still being monitored by that woman and suspected in a murder.
Yeah, and then also you and the Melbourne, Australia listeners are on the wavelength. That
and this also, we should have someone who's knowledgeable about the Australian film industry come on, because I don't know much about it, and I feel like this could be an educational opportunity if there are other Australian listeners.
Have any of you been to Australia?
No, it's so far away.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I'd like to go.
It's ridiculous because it's far away, or it's ridiculous when you get there, it's ridiculous?
No, it's so far. I would really love to go, but it takes like a day and a half to get there.
Yeah.
I see.
You know, I would really love to...
Alien Covenant, but my passport had expired.
Wow, that's a sad story.
Yeah, I know. White entertainment journalist problems.
Yeah, I figured that set visits would maybe be my best chance to ever get to Australia because, you know, someone else is paying for the very expensive ticket, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Think for a moment of just how amazing kangaroos are.
You can see kangaroos here. There are kangaroos, and apparently in Australia, no one likes them that much.
Yeah, my brother lived in Australia for a year working on a sheep farm, and all of his favorite pictures are him with kangaroos he shot. He flipped a tractor one time.
Wow.
Yeah, guys, there needs to be like some sort of weird movie about my brother's weird coming out years in Australia.
It's called
On a
Kangaroo
Sheep
Jack.
Farm.
Is that what Kangaroo Jack's about?
Yep, that is what it's about.
He came out and shot kangaroos simultaneously?
Well, he came out and then like went to Australia to discover, I don't know, I think it was like an Australian-American Brokeback Mountain situation.
You say sheep farm, and I think Brokeback Mountain, but that sounds so tragic. Yeah. I feel like your brother's doing pretty well.
Well, I mean, he got
walked about than anything.
Yeah, he got out of Australia. I feel like this tangent is detracting from our plea, which is, if you're part of the Australian film industry, get in contact, maybe through our Facebook page, as we see is here, or tweet at us, because, yeah, that and the China film industry... I need to know more about.
We apologize for mansplaining in the last episode. I didn't.
Well,
I thought talking about female driven. Right. Exactly. So what would you have said? We were defending, or we were not defending. We were putting these out there, endorsing. I didn't think it was mansplaining, but we were pretty wink wink about it.
The first comment of the segment is, I wish we had some girls on to talk about blank. So we tried, but
we tried.
Acknowledged.
We failed, but we tried.
Anything that's man me clean for me gone.
One, two, three.
about some other stuff that's going on that, I don't have an opinion on because I haven't seen it. So, men, tell me about Lost City of Z. I have, however, seen every James Gray movie, so I have opinions on James Gray.
We should definitely talk about James Gray in a macro sense, but let me mansplain for one second here, because you called it The Lost City of Z.
And you said the wrong name. It's the wrong name.
The rest of the segment, we will be referring to the proper name of this film, The Lost City of Zed.
Oh, shit. Because this is a really?
British film. And this is what they say. This is what Percy Fawcett, British explorer of the early 20th century, when he set out to the Amazon, he was not searching for the Lost City of Z. He was searching for the Lost City of Zed.
They say Zed like 25,000 times in the movie. It's awesome.
He screams Zed in front of British explorers who are waving their noses up at him. And he says, Zed, we will find Zed.
It's pretty funny because when I remember, we all saw the movie, I saw it anyhow, last October for the New York Film Festival, and I was covering it for The Guardian, which, as you know, is a British publication. So I even made a joke when I strolled into the theater. I said to a number of colleagues, I'm like, you all are seeing The Lost City of Z, but I'm seeing The Lost City of Zed. And then when they started saying Zed, I'm like, oh, my God, we're all seeing The Lost City of Zed. This is great. Go ahead. Yes.
Oh, let me, before we dive into the film itself, it should be noted that people have spent many, many years trying to make this this story based on a book by David Gran, a 2009 book, ever since he put this book out. James Gray was going to direct it and Brad Pitt was going to star in it. He ended up producing it through his Plan B Entertainment faction.
Plan B having a good run lately.
Yeah, for sure. I mean...
I can only imagine what Plan A was, because Plan B is so
good. Yeah, so Brad Pitt did not play Colonel Percy Fawcett. Probably a good thing. I can't imagine. Has he done a British accent?
Ooh.
Brad Pitt? Someone check that.
Interview with the Vampire? No, that's not said here.
I can hear it in my head. I can hear it in my Legend of the Fall was not, but I can hear it in my head. I can hear him trying to do one.
You guys think about this, or I'll think about this while you guys keep talking.
Okay. Well, then, so after Brad Pitt, was going to be Benedict Cumberbatch. That didn't work out. I could not see him in this role because Charlie Hunnam of Sons of Anarchy and Pacific Rim, he plays this explorer character and is really, I mean, this is his movie, and he commands the screen in this. Jordan, what is it?
My best guess for British accent. Sorry, that was a bad interruption. Yeah, no, my best guess for the accent is in Troy as Achilles. He might have a British accent.
I was just about to say, Troy, maybe 7 years in Tibet. I don't remember that one too well, but he definitely tried to do one at one point, and it was not a good look on him. But
yes, he had that famous line where he was like, Paris, hello, Paris. I'm going to fight in the name of the Trojans. Hello.
No, no, he did. Anyway, he did have one in Troy because he had to talk to Patroclus, and he's like, Patroclus. You know, that's how he would say it.
You were so close to talking about something we actually intended to talk about, and I ruined it. Go back.
Almost did. I know.
I ruined it. Go.
Jordan was about to sing the praises of this actually pretty amazing movie that spent a lot of time in development and turned out to be pretty darn okay. Jordan.
Tangents are okay because, like The Road to Zed, it is a watery, windy way that has tangents and little rivulets and whatnot. It's great. You know, basically, it's an adventurer's tale. It is, you know, it's funny. You said earlier, men tell me about this movie. It's a very macho movie, although it does have, what's her name? Sienna Miller plays the wife left at home.
Too.
And she doesn't have much to do until the very end where she gets the best scene. She knocks it out of the park. And if you saw James Gray's truly terrific film, The Immigrant, from a few years ago, which had like the best last shot in recent cinema, I almost feel like James Gray went to this new one and said, I gotta top that last shot. And he did.
Amazing.
The last shot like had everybody just breathless. You could hear a pin drop when I saw it the first time. But, you know, as far as the story, he's an explorer and he believes, as has since been confirmed, that indigenous tribes in the Amazonian rainforest had very complex civilizations. And at this time in British history, which is at some point during the Victorian era, people were still on the fence about this. And they didn't believe that a couple of shattered bits of pottery meant anything specific. But this man knew it and he felt it. And the movie is about him getting an exposition together, and he's going to kind of kiss the ring of various individuals who are financing it. And then he goes, and then there's trouble, and he's got to go back to London.
Reclaiming his name, right? Like, he is the son of a drunk, and this adventure it's more than just discovery. It's redemption for something that it's never been his problem.
Well, the movie begins at, like, they're at a ball, as these things often are, and you hear these sort of aristocratic dudes chatting, like, oh, who is that gentleman over there? And they talk about him. He's like, oh, what's his problem? He goes, well, he had the misfortune of being born to his parents, you know? So it was like a really great sort of British class struggle there. You know, it's a type of movie that they don't make anymore, which is James Gray's whole deal, right? I mean, The Immigrant is a very sort of classic, late 70s, early 80s, Paramount type of movie. And this definitely has that sort of early 1980s large scope sort of, Chariots of Fire winning for
Mission.
Bigger stuff,
Shadow and it lives up to those too. I mean, I'm surprised. I guess I always think that James Gray has to be relegated to making smaller budget films because he's out there and there's maybe a niche audience for them at this point. But this is a big movie with lush visuals in the Amazon. Yeah. And then when he comes back to England, he's fighting in World War One at some point, and it's a sprawling story. Yeah. It starts in like 1906 or 1908 and then goes through the 1930s. I mean, this is a really big epic story, and then there's a lot of intimate scenes. There's a lot of small moments with Charlie Hunnam and his family, knocking heads, trying to be like, it has a Close Encounters, I'm driven to the Amazon kind of mystique to it. He's abandoning his kids time and time again to go back to the jungle.
He's abandoning his kids until his eldest son is old enough to join him on this cockamamie adventure. But, it's true. It does have a broad scope, and there are some scenes of World War One, but it is not a $100 million movie. I mean, it's a very smart with its budget. If you know where to look for budget shortcuts, they're in there. But it's just very, very smartly made, and what they do throw up on the screen is all the location stuff. Yes, it's vomit. But it's very, very beautiful because they're shooting on location in Latin America. And everybody's wearing, like, the great costumes. And there's, like, the doofus that has to come along on one of the expeditions because he's funding it, and he's a sort of this big coward and whatnot. And it's just all really, really terrific. But what's funny is that it works really great in counterpoint with a movie that came out about a year and a half ago called Embrace of the Serpent, which is a movie from the point of view of the indigenous tribes in Latin America when explorers are coming to visit them. And this is a little bit more the traditional because it's the sort of Western point of view, but be that as it may, it's still a really, really well-made and terrific kind of classicist type of story. And somebody's going to find something in there that's offensive to indigenous peoples in this film. And, but it's also about the times. I mean, it is, in fact, based on a true story. So,
but to be clear, Percy, the explorer here, is a proponent of these people that the English regard as savages. He's trying to connect the world with the indigenous, and he's respecting them, that they have this lost city of Zed, and they have this entire civilization that people are ready to overlook or ready to gun down. And he is woke, for lack of a better word. He realizes the world, we're all equals.
I haven't seen this movie, so I don't want to go too hard on it, but does it not have the problem that, it's about this Amazon civilization, but it's celebrating the white guy who wants to talk about it and not that civilization itself? Do we need another movie celebrating that?
Well, I don't know if it's celebrating the, like, colonialism or the white invasion, or there's no white savior. No one's saving the day here. They're not helping these people. In fact, it's about coming to terms with accepting these people and understanding who they really are, and that they perhaps cannot be studied, but they can only become, you can only be immersed in what they've crafted in the Amazon.
Right. There, I mean, there are scenes of like where there's talk of like, oh, there's cannibalism here and whatnot. I mean, I think Katie's touched upon something that some critics are going to scratch at that scab and say that this is even beneath the sort of enlightened surface, there is, an imperialist vibe. And I mean, that's just I think to deny that would be a waste of breath, because it's just, you know, it's based on a true story. And I think this guy's attitudes were pure for their time. But, you know, do we need this story again? I say absolutely, because it's just really cool. And, you know, movies like this that would have been made in the 1960s would have treated the indigenous people much, much, much worse than they are now. You know, they would. I mean, you can look at some of those films like Khartoum or Zulu or whatnot, you know, British films from the 60s that went to, you know, even Lawrence of Arabia to a certain degree, that treated imperialism as like the great last enlightenment age, doesn't hold up too well right now in terms of, political sensibilities. And I'm very curious to read an essay about this film that takes it to task and does it in a bright way, because I would like to have my opinion shook a little bit, because personally, I think the movie's really, really great. But I'm open to hear why I'm wrong about that.
Well, and Katie, Jordan, you were talking about how James Gray makes movies like they don't make him anymore. And I feel like every one of his movies kind of comes up with a question where it's like, do we need another Cops in Brooklyn movie? Do we need another, you know, innocent woman corrupted in the big city movie? Or I think of Two Lovers, especially, where it's like, it's a romance about quiet people. And like, you don't think that it's going to break new ground by that movie existing, but they're always so well told and so moving that they really feel valuable. So I definitely see what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think each of his movies is getting better and better. This is my favorite of
his.
This
is his best movie. I really want to pose this question to Katie, because we mentioned early that you had seen many of his films and you might have opinions on all of them. But my personal take is that James Gray has made a lot of very good movies, but I'm not sure I've ever been blown away or I've stood by one to the end of the year and called it my favorite movie of the year. They're just like really accomplished, but I'm not sure they've ever moved me.
The immigrant knocked me out, but part of that was because there was a little time in my life when I was really obsessed with that time period, and I was just really taken with the period details in The Immigrant. So The Immigrant is my second favorite of his. So I see him on if there's a graph out there, right? It's just the line is just going up, up, up. But Katie, did you see The Immigrant?
Yeah. Oh no, I loved The Immigrant. And like, it definitely had such like heightened feelings in production design, and it was very arch. I mean, arch is not the right word. It was stagey in a way that I think turned a lot of people off. And I thought it was so impressive.
But that's the thing: is it? It's impressive, but did it get under your skin? Is it like is it a great movie? Is it resonating?
You know, the one that I think came the closest, and it's hard to remember it clearly because it came in the middle of Joaquin Phoenix's big stunt meltdown. But Two Lovers is really great and really affecting and well acted and thoughtful, and it definitely stuck with me when I saw it. But again, I wind up associating it with like Joaquin Phoenix and the glasses and the beard, so it's hard to remember properly.
Yeah. I would like to see that one again, and I know that one of the local art houses is playing it again soon. I would like to check that out. But
Every James Gray movie seems to come with the like the underappreciated masterpiece. Like every, I mean, We Own the Night is really good. I don't like it. That one really gets unremembered. You don't like We Own the Night?
Maybe I should see it again, but I saw that one back at like a midnight screening at college, and it did not work for me. It has an amazing car chase, but I just thought
it was a car chase. Really, and Eva Mendes is great in it, and it's one of the movies. It's the movie that convinced me that she is also constantly underappreciated.
Yeah. I think Wahlberg is the stain on that one. I don't know.
Oh, isn't it always the case?
It is.
I mean,
okay,
it's funny. Like, just say, James Gray for me is like a Sidney Lumet type, you know, which I think has probably been written about before. But I mean, Sidney Lumet, when he was really in his groove in the 1980s, was pounding out movies regularly. And like a movie like Prince of the City, which is not really that well remembered right now, because it's a New York City cop movie and there's a zillion of those, was just one that really had a hold on me for a while. I just remember because when I was a kid, it was the one that was a double VHS. So I remember being this like obsessed with the box because like, oh my God, this is such a big movie. It's got two VHS tapes. So I remember watching that one more than once. And for whatever reason, that was a movie that I thought was like as important as The Godfather. This is stupid, I realize now, just because I had two boxes. But be that as it may, and I'm always surprised that not as many people remember Prince of the City. But, you know, he did it along with Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon and all these others. And I think that if Gray was alive back then, he'd be making movies on the reg, as they say now, because the you know, his movies don't make money and they're for weird niche audiences in Europe. You know, they love him in France. He puts one out every 4 years. So that's the world we live in.
That's the big disappointment here, that I would rather just get James Gray's summer blockbusters every year. I was thinking during a scene where early on Percy and his crew, which Robert Pattinson is his number one here. There's some great casting in this movie. Robert Pattinson, giant Brooklyn beard in this movie, and total hipster, goes on the Explorer, and they are on a raft and they fall over into the water and the piranhas are getting them and they're being shot with arrows and every other food rations might be falling off the boat, so they have to keep it steady. It's just a crazy, so many action elements
this
are happening
like
in this
Revenant.
Moment.
It sounds like The Revenant.
It is kind of like The Revenant.
So
well,
much,
but it's not
so
such a drag. Yeah, it's
so
lush, and they're really chasing something. You know where they're going at all times and why they're driven to these points. There's real soul to this movie where I didn't get that from The Revenant, but it's still an action movie. It still has this adventurous nature, and like the World War One scenes too. I'm like, this could be a summer blockbuster that we would feed people, but no, we got to get something more bombastic, I suppose.
It would be it's like the nicer version of Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Werner Herzog's films, because the lead character is not a murdering asshole. It's just like, but he's got that obsession, and it's the same sort of like, you know, the horrors of the elements in the jungle, and it's just really, really cool. I'm looking at my review, which was published way back when, and yeah, all the movies we've been talking about. I mentioned The Mission and
congrats, so you nailed it. You lived up to the written
word.
You passed
your own quiz.
Well, no, because you mentioned it earlier, Yishmendrick. So,
all right.
We should also point out that it's not just any cinematographer. It's Darius Kanji, who is like one of the, if we were one of these DP, you know, jizz wizards who love to scream about cinematographers. He's one of those cinematographers that have you know, lots of dudes lusting after his f-stops. So
sounds,
you know,
like you're part of that clan. Anyway, let's wrap up. So The Lost City of Zed comes Zed. Out
how
in
many,
New York and LA this
how
weekend.
How many jizz wizards does it get out of five?
I gave it four shots of jizz when I reviewed it back in
people October. Say this podcast is too male. You guys need to shut up.
This is a family show. Yeah. Talk about it female terms here. Ladies
ew,
can jizz too.
No.
Anyway, so The Lost City of Zed comes out in New York, No, I'm talking about when the movie's coming out. It expands next weekend, and it'll be on Amazon eventually because Amazon Studios is putting out. Wrap this stupid up.
Get you what you're looking for. That crack. My name Wayne, and I came to party. My watch are icy, and my chain are frosty. The gifts like me, but they mains are salty. I ain't on strike three, but his brains are cost me. I'm a chill, like waiting for the doctor. I'm a waiting for the proper head doctor. Hey, I need a check. Up and mommy telling me her man need to step up. I'm like, say no more, cause there's the door. And my niggas like, I ain't trying to hate on yours. I'm like,
hey, Katie, you just got back from a big trip down south. That's why we missed you last week. But where were you? You went to a big thing that well, besides your life plans that we'll talk about later. But where you went to a big event?
Yeah, I went to the Masters, which, as you know, I know it's very on brand for me as someone who talks about golf all the time. No, the Masters makes no sense for me to attend at all, unless you know that I am from Aiken, South Carolina, which is just across the Savannah River from Augusta, Georgia, which is where the Masters are held. And the Masters have always been this crazy prestigious golf tournament. Back like when my parents were, you know, around my age in the 70s and 80s, getting tickets was basically just as easy as putting your name on a list. And my dad put his name on the list in 1975 or 1974 around then. Then they closed the waiting list, so you could no longer register for tickets. So he was on the waiting list for 15 years and finally started getting tickets in about 1990. And so every year he gets sent these tickets, which are somewhat expensive, but by, you know, major sporting event are not too bad. I think they're now $300 face value, and that's 4 days of golf that you get for that, which is pretty good when you break it down. And my parents often sell them because the Masters have become this crazy event where private jets will fly into the tiny airport in my hometown and bring like execs from Google to just go to the Masters. It's like the Super Bowl where you like, you know, some normal people get to go, but it's a lot of like fancy corporate events that want to show off to their clients. And so the fact that we have tickets at all is kind of this weird, random thing. And this year we actually kept them and I got to go to the Masters for the first time since I was about 12. The main reason is that my father-in-law is a big golf fan and was like, achieving nirvana walking into the Augusta National, which if you've ever watched like even CBS during April, you see like the shots of the greens and the azaleas and the, you know, hushed white man voice telling you it's a tradition unlike any other. And there's this huge mythos built up around the Augusta National, which famously also did not admit women until about 5 years ago, although women have been able to attend the Masters to watch it for a while. Which is
now it's just orgies. They just have orgies nonstop.
I know. Well, you let women in, and just like decency falls apart.
Orgies. Did Mother come with Pence? I'm just curious.
Stop.
I've actually.
You're getting too political.
Well, the historical thing is that presidents are always invited to join the Augusta National, and I believe Barack Obama was at least invited, even if he didn't join. I'm curious if Trump is going to join because, you know, Mar-a-Lago is the best golf club. Terrific.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing better.
You know, now that there's women there, but just real quick, now that it's women there, it's now called the Masters and Johnson, strangely enough. So,
Oh, boy. So Katie, okay. I've watched the Masters on television last year, especially for some reason. It was on and a lot of people were talking about it. Danny Willett won and there were big upsets and it was like a real event to watch. And for the first time in my life, it was on my radar and I was like sitting there and watching golf and I had a pretty good time.
Now, did I wind up watching golf?
Well, I've listened to you talk about golf at length on Little Golf Men for many years.
Jordan brings up terrible things in you.
Hello. But what do you do at the Masters? Is it involving? Like, I could imagine being around a crowd and starting to be really absorbed in something that I never cared about if I'm like there at the Masters.
I mean, honestly, I think that your odds of getting more absorbed in it the way you weren't before is kind of the way you did it, where on Master Sunday, it's the end of the tournament, there are these stakes that are set up for it. You're like, oh, this guy's two strokes behind. And then you get to every, you know, putting green, and you're like, oh, well, if he gets it in, he gets to get ahead. I mean, I find this for most sporting events. Like, I get into March Madness every year, having paid zero attention to college football or college basketball the rest of the year. I don't mind that. I think if you, like, being a fair weather fan of a sport is totally fine if you make no bones about it because it's entertaining. But maybe the best thing I can say for going to the Masters in person, which I acknowledge is something that many, many people will never get to do, they totally ban cell phones from the Augusta National. Like, you leave your cell phone in the car. If you are seen with us, I mean, they check your bag when you go in, and if you bring your phone out, like, you get kicked out and your tickets are pulled forever. They are like crazy solid because they just want you to pay attention to the golf. And they get there's a private club so they can make whatever rules they want. But it is amazing to walk into like a very large park where you walk around in this beautiful grass and trees and you don't have your phone and you just gotta walk around and focus on the thing that you're doing. And like,
well, I have to ask you a question. I have to because I'm fascinated by this. I understand going to a basketball game, soccer game, whatever, you sit and you watch the game. In golf, there's a whole course. There's, what is it, the 18 holes, right?
Yeah.
So do you sit at one hole and watch all the guys go and then everybody gets in a cart and goes to hole number two? Or how do you one guy around?
Well, you can kind of do it either way. Like, you know, my brother and sister-in-law went and they set up their chairs. I got there very early. They set up their chairs right by the green at 16, which is like an interesting hole because it goes right over a lake. So there's a lot of drama involved.
You only see the part of the show that you go to.
Well, but then you can also do basically what I did with my father-in-law, where we walked around and we, you know, stopped by five and we stopped by six and we sat in the bleachers for a while and watched a couple people putt and you position yourself in different places. I mean, that's the way that I like doing it because my interest in the actual sport is pretty minimal. I don't know anything about swings or clubs or anything.
Let's say there's like I imagine there are some famous golfers. I don't know. Tiger Woods is the only golfer I've ever heard of. So imagine, was he there? Did he play or is he done?
He did not play this year.
Who's the new guy? guy? Who's the new Tiger
Jordan
Woods?
Jordan Spieth is a big guy. The guy who won.
Sergio Garcia won.
Sergio Garcia head.
You love this guy.
Yeah.
Do you? Can you follow him? Can you like tag yourself to this guy and follow him around all afternoon?
It'd be logistically, you'd have to like really hurry because you know the golfers can like get from place to place quicker than you can to get through the crowds. But you totally could. It's kind of like it's like Sleep No More. You choose your own experience.
Wow.
And like you're in.
I have to say something to you, and then I'll shut up. I have no interest in going to any sporting event ever. Ever. I've been to football, basketball. It's always a drag. I eat a hot dog and I look at my phone now. I would go to see golf because to me, it's fascinating. You could do a Sleep No More. They should advertise.
Walk around.
Is there golf tournaments in New York that I can go to?
The only golf course I can think of in New York is Trump-owned. I don't think you want to go to that one.
That guy is no friend of mine. All right. Well, listen, Katie, I find this very interesting. I'm going to shut up now. Continue talking.
No, I mean, yeah, you can choose your own experience. You get the food at the Masters is famously cheap. You get a pimento cheese sandwich for $1.50 and a beer for $3. And you can walk around. And it's Georgia in April. It's not too hot yet. Most years, the azaleas are blooming. This year, there was an early frost, so they couldn't quite get it. It was incredibly pleasant. And there were no phones. And I sat in the stands and I waited for my father-in-law, who was in the bathroom. And I was by myself. And I had no phone. I had nothing to read. And I just sat there and there was golf for like 10 minutes. And then there would be a pause until the next people came up. And I just looked at the trees and it was great. So my main recommendation is turning off your phone. you can replicate my joy in the Masters by turning off your phone and going outside.
The big question is, have you convinced Dave to go to the Masters? Dave, are you going to go to the Masters?
I've been to golf tournaments before. I like golf tournaments.
Hey,
you really?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of you, you know, you get there early enough to kind of figure out how the day's matches are shaping up, and then you got to peg the holes that are going to be important pretty early on by watching the game and watching the board. It used to be kind of a game to try to get to the right holes to see the people that you wanted to see. But yeah, it definitely is like a Sleep No More of sporting events.
Dave likes planting himself at the windmills, but not those tricky ones where you have to hit up a slope.
Yeah, I don't like anything with anthropomorphized things that are swiping at your ball.
Dinosaur mouth.
That's just not fair.
Yeah, no, the T-Rex mouth at Augusta is famous for being most
very tough.
Now, Katie, I know you're from South Carolina. Have you been to a little place called Myrtle Beach?
Oh, well.
Remarkable putt-putt courses on Myrtle Beach. I have done
some real putt-putt course damage in Myrtle Beach, so I would call myself an aficionado of Myrtle Beach putt-putt.
Would you call yourself a master?
No, I'm pretty terrible at putt-putt, but I enjoy it greatly.
And while we give Patches the hook, we will move on to our next segment.
So a couple weeks ago, I helped edit a piece that ran at VanityFair.com called Game Over Uwe Boll. It's actually Uwe. I'm already doing a bad job of pronouncing his name. It's a long profile of Uwe Boll, who, if you know him at all, you may know him as the guy who boxed a bunch of his critics. He's the filmmaker behind movies like Postal and In the Name of the King, A Dungeon Siege Tale, and Attack on Darfur. And he's kind of he's both a maker of movies that people hate and really pugilistic about it. He basically agreed to this profile in Vanity Fair because he thought it was time for people to properly appreciate his genius. And the writer Darren King, who I think did a really good job of kind of capturing that without really making fun of him and kind of having respect for the work that he has put into it. It's a great piece that you should all read. If you Google Uwe Boll Vanity Fair, you'll find it. I edited this piece. I worked with Darren for a long time, kind of putting it together. And then I told Patches that I have seen very few, if really any, Uwe Boll movies. Like, they've come out as I've been working, writing about movies. They have never, like, I've never been assigned to them. I've never really had the desire to seek them out. I think I know a lot about him and about his work, and I could edit the piece. I don't think I would have written the piece having not seen any of his movies. And Patches, you thought this was terrible because I needed to have seen these terrible movies. But I, as much as I'm interested in him as a person, I have no interest in seeking out a movie that everyone tells me is really terrible. This is not part of my DNA.
Right. Well, that's the interesting thing about Uwe Boll, I think, that his career spans good, bad, and bad, bad movies. He's done things that seem self-aware and are hilarious if you're in the right setting and you're ready to like watch something unfold that you can't imagine how all the wrong choices could be made and no one seems aware, and it is a blissful tragedy of a movie. And then you have movies that are going out of their way, like Postal and some of the Blood Rain movies that he made, that are just are troll jobs and trying to be terrible and staring America, staring culture in the face and flipping at the bird. That is part of his reputation as well. Postal especially.
We also
that.
Made a I mean, bunch Postal, of – he made a bunch of video game movies and famously saw no point in video games, which I think helped him earn his reputation as being angry
and then, like,
at his
rejecting,
fans.
Rejecting the – kind of premises of those video games and seizing him for his own. I mean, Postal is technically based on a video game and has very little to do with that video game. The movie opens with the 9/11 hijackers debating how many virgins are going to get when they crash into the Trey Towers, and then they realize that it's all a sham and they probably are going to die and not get any virgins, but then it's, oh, it's too late. They crash into the World Trade Center and they shoots it from, like, you see a window washer, and that's how it ends. That's the beginning of Postal, and it gets even crazier. Just an asshole of a guy. And but he's still an artist, and I think I've always been.
Hey, did you see me roll my eyes through the audio?
This takes a person to make this shit, and sometimes it's outsider art and funny, and sometimes it's just like he made this movie Assault on Wall Street, which is about it stars Dominic Purcell of Prison Break. And it's about a guy going postal, because it's not the movie Postal, about after the financial crisis, the, you know, 07, 08 financial crisis and shooting up banks and shit. And there's a lot of anger there. That's real. It's a really bad movie, but it's not a fun bad movie. It's just carnage and it's just sadness and disgusting. And but it has a point. And
he made a movie called Auschwitz, too, which never showed anywhere in the U.S., but I just remember the trailer. It was really tasteless.
You know, that's why he spun out of control, because he's too much of an artist. And that, Katie, this is why I'm saying there is room for bad movies that are fun that I would recommend, and then there's a distinction, right? I guess that's the question that's on the table for this segment.
Yeah.
Are there bad movies? And we talk about this so much. Part of the reason we're talking about this is because Mystery Science Theater 3000 is coming back on Netflix this week, this Friday, and that is a show that celebrates bad movies as outsider art, as something that can be made fun of, that can be stretched and contorted and recontextualized for fun. And it's playful fun, because these movies, we need them to exist in order to have fun with them. Like, and you can't try and manufacture the shit that flows through Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Well, that's the key point. It's got to be pure. You can't fake it. You can't create a cult classic. It has to happen au naturel. And the movies that are usually highlighted on, people try and they fail. They think, oh, this is going to be so campy that people are just going to love it, and they don't.
By the way, I'm just kidding.
Say that again.
The movie that tries to be bad up front and fails because it's trying to manufacture the camp or
like the Sharknado movies.
Yeah,
or really snakes on a plane.
That's another great example. But yeah, the Sharknado films are the quintessential example of fake bad, right? The real bad movies like The Room, or movies like I've had the good fortune to see some of the Neil Breen films that showed in Austin, and just all the classic Ed Wood, Plan 9 from Outer Space, things like that. They have to be made by people that think they're doing something great and don't realize that they're making a disaster. Now, part of that is sort of punching down and sort of making fun of somebody's inability to do something, but it has to have an ineffable quality of, why have I seen Plan 9 from Outer Space multiple times? It's really quite charming. You know, there's a something about it that's just pure and terrific.
Plan 9 is an interesting movie to point out, because is it actually I mean, I guess it's bad, but it got a reputation as a bad, bad movie from Michael Medved. Not that reputable of a critic, if not to slam the Medveds, but they wrote a book about the golden turkeys. I wrote a piece about this at the Dissolve eons ago, but they kind of gave the reputation of bad movies and started calling out movies that were bad, golden turkeys, and Plan 9 is the king of them all.
I think one of – I'll give you – yes. And actually, Frank Zappa did a whole bit about this also called Cheapness, and he talked about films like Plan 9. It works on a couple levels. On a very sort of surface level, Plan 9 from Outer Space is bad because you can see that the UFOs are, you know, pie plates, right? I mean, you can just see bad special effects. The suspension of disbelief does not suspend itself because you would clearly see that these are not aliens. It just looks and the spaceships are just like a room with, you know, bad curtains on them, you know, and so it fails on that level. And then the storytelling is incoherent and the acting is not very believable. And, you know, it ultimately all rolls together into something that is not good. But why is it not good? It's not good because it doesn't tell the story, because you keep calling attention to the fact that you're watching a poorly made motion picture. So that is what happens in Plan 9 and in The Room and in other films, you know. But it also happens in some movies that some people like for other reasons. Like, I think the Ghost Rider 2 by Neville Dean and Taylor is terrible, but some people like that legitimately, and I don't know what the hell they're talking about.
I mean, I really liked it, but I definitely drank like half a bottle of whiskey before.
Yeah, and then we saw Katie that, and then saw Phantom and then Menace afterward.
3D
at midnight. Dave, weren't you there too?
Oh yeah, but I had to wake somebody up at some point. I don't need to blow
Me.
Up anybody's
spot. No, yes. Definitely fell asleep in Phantom Menace.
I get made fun of for falling asleep during the middle section of Phantom Menace, despite defending it to the end. I was drunk. It wasn't my fault.
But, you know, there is something
Ghost Rider 2.
I mean, here's the thing. Let's talk about bad movies as a social thing, right? Because we all love movies, and when you get a bunch of people to your house and you get people who really love cinema and you've maybe had a few drinks, you don't want to go, oh, man, I got the Blu-ray of Moonlight. You know, nobody wants to do that. You want to give Moonlight respect, and it's not like a social thing to hang out and watch Moonlight or Manchester by the Sea or something that is quote-unquote good. But I love, and I still have the disc. I take it out from time to time, an Italian sci-fi film from 1970-something called Cosmos Battle of the Planets, which is completely incoherent. It's just, you know, has terrible costumes. It has awful dialogue, but has really hilarious use of robots and whatnot, and it's a really great movie to show people when you want to have a good time. So in that regard, it serves a purpose, right? I mean, that movie is a great time, and I've shown it at parties, and everybody loves it. So, you know, who's laughing now?
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, there's a
Oscar to that movie instead of Moonlight, right? I mean, come on.
They're fun, bad movies, like, that are like super recent too. You don't have to go like super obscure, like Super Mario Brothers, the movie, a good example of foreign people coming in and not having any idea what they were doing and legitimately trying to do something cool to get smuddled out.
Recent? That was 1993.
But Jordan, you guys are talking about like Plan 9 and stuff. I'm just trying to bring it like slightly more.
I was waiting to hear like Transformers 3 or something.
Well, actually, I mean, like, that might be that's definitely in there, but like Dungeons and Dragons 2000 before that. Good.
Right.
Go ahead,
this is what I wanted to ask you, Dave. Do you think that movies can get... Are we at a time where we're not going to make any more bad movies? If Uwe Boll is giving up, he can't get any more Nazi gold to fund his movies. Do you think that movies are too big and that the Hollywood machine is too picky or too precise, too many cooks in the kitchen to make a truly visionary bad movie? Because I think... You know, you mentioned Transformers, Katie. I think there's just too many hands on this product to make it truly bad in a fun way. It's just a bad and a grueling, pushing IP way. We have recent examples. Like Batman and Robin is a good bad movie for me. Or like The Happening, M. Night Shyamalan's movie from not that long ago, is a disaster but so funny. And we're kind of that's slipping away, I think.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, part of it is because some of the lower budget ones just never get picked up. There's so much material out there in film markets that if something is just bad on its own, forget the Sharknado stuff. That stuff has an audience, intentionally bad. But the weirdo bad that we're talking about that slips through the cracks, there's so much other material of that movie. Those movies just die on the vine and never get picked up by even the worst of distributors, yeah. You know?
Everyone should go to the Cannes film market at some point in their life. Don't go to the Cannes Film Festival. Fly to Cannes in the middle of May and go to the Cannes film market to really get a taste of what good bad movies are like.
Oh, man. I mean, okay, what about like 2010's Alice in Wonderland? I don't like that movie, but everybody likes that movie.
That's the IP. Bad.
Yeah, that's exactly. And it also makes a zillion dollars. And some people like it. You know, moron kids like it, but, you know, it's an issue. Yeah, I mean, like some of these, you know, and the MST3K stuff, they're not going to have any new movies on. And forget just the licensing rights. It's because it's a time capsule. It's from a different era. You know, when there was a time that if you made any kind of movie at all, because it was more difficult to make a film. Now the kids today they got a whole movie studio in their pocket with their goddamn iPhones. Back in the day, you had to go to the lab, get your film processed. You had to cut it. You know, it was a big deal. So by the time you were done, somebody was going to show it somewhere. You know, less material, less product.
And
so.
You don't want to punch down. You don't want to make fun. And have fun at the expense of an indie movie. Well, very often.
Have you guys heard about The Evil Within? That was this year. So it's one of the Getty family.
What is that about? I saw people talking about that.
Yeah. One of the Getty family, millionaire, spends 15 years shooting a horror movie, bits and pieces, like, you know, like over 20 cinematographers because he can't keep it on with like his weird progressive thing, ends up like having like some sort of meth addiction, died at 47 because of results of that, and then the movie was finished posthumously and it's now on Amazon streaming, and it's apparently this weird horror movie about a mentally handicapped person who when an old mirror is moved into his room starts killing people. But that's, it seems like, at least from the buzz that I've heard of the weirdo horror sect, that this could evolve into one of those weirds for weird's sake cult films that isn't good because I hear, you know, the performance obviously centering around a mentally handicapped person told over a 15-year span. You're going through a lot of different politically correctness there, so I'm pretty sure what he ended up with isn't great. But as a idea of like this, you know, rich, crazy meth addict made a horror movie over 15 years and they had to release it because he was never finished with it. I feel like this has got some possible heat.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds infinitely more interesting than the every week bullshit VOD IFC Midnight junk that comes out that, you know, gets reviewed on Bloody Disgusting I used to cover that stuff week to week for the New York Daily News, and it was a horror. There was never anything good. And this at least has a provenance that is intriguing, you know? So I would much rather see that.
Yeah, the days of good bad horror movies seem over completely because everyone is making horror movies and you'd rather celebrate the great ones than kind of bask in the
there are so many bad horror special effects.
The solution for this to go to any local film festival, like anything beyond Sundance, Toronto, New York Film Festival? Like Tribeca is full of many of the worst movies I've ever seen.
But not that they're taking themselves seriously, and they usually are maudlin. They're not usually bad. They're not disasters because the film festival still has a quality control to it. So you see movies that are trying to be good and maybe on paper were good. And these are not bad movies that you want to enjoy the badness of. You want
I'm going to bring up a movie that I've enjoyed the badness of. I've only seen it at the Sundance Film Festival in 2010, and it is the movie 12, which I'm pretty sure has been completely forgotten by history. Joel Schumacher movie about wild teens on the Upper East Side. It stars Chase Crawford of Gossip Girl, Roy Culkin, 50 Cent, Zoe Kravitz, Emma Roberts, and it's a movie in which one character spends most of it wielding a samurai sword, but then someone shoots a bunch of people. Samurai sword literally never gets used.
least.
Right, right. You know what it is? That's a subsect of bad, and it's not what we're talking about, because there are a lot of these bad movies that play at the festivals that have stars in them, have names.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's especially Tribeca. I mean, we remember all the ones, Mr. Brooks or whatever it was called with Eddie Murphy last year, and Jesus Henry Christ. We all remember that disaster.
Oh, God.
And those are movies that are really sad, because they're usually, it's some rich kid who wants to make a movie and has access to financing because their dad is a lawyer and blah, blah, blah. And we know that score. And though that's not fun. What's fun is when it's like the documentary American Movie, you know, those lunatics that scrape and strive and try to get something together and create something that's just complete outsider art. And that's why it's interesting. I mean, that's why The Room is interesting. And that's why the new film, which I have not seen yet, the disaster artist, James Franco's film about The Room, is supposedly quite good. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm just saying that it's a rarer thing. It's a rarer thing these days.
So we were talking a little about Punching Down and celebrating something that someone invested time and money in and creativity, and you're laughing at it. Is that okay? You know, I wrote this piece for Thrillist about Mac and Me, which is not a good movie, but I definitely saw it as a kid. It's super goofy. And I took it really seriously because people made this movie, right? Like, I talked to the producer and they worked with McDonald's and the charities. They wanted to make a movie with a disabled kid. And this guy really had, spina bifida?
Spina bifida.
Yeah, and wow, it's such a noble effort. And like, yeah, he talks about wanting to make a ripoff of E.T., but it was a good cause. Like, they wanted an E.T. for a new generation 5 years later after the original E.T. And they wanted to raise money for the Ronald McDonald House charities. Great, that's fantastic. And this guy, I mean, this movie clearly didn't go well. Paul Rudd goes on Conan every year and makes fun of it. And yet he wants to make a sequel. Like, he just thinks that this was the one miss on his entire filmography. And he doesn't realize it has this legacy of being a bad movie. He's never even heard of Paul Rudd going on Conan and making fun of it. And he wants to make a sequel. And it's just like, right. How do you deal with that?
So you feel a little bad.
Well,
you
know, that's exactly why it's hilarious and fun. Like, the movie is
it
not
is.
Good.
And but it's a little bit, you're right, it's not nice. It's not, your grandmother wouldn't be happy for you if you did it. And I'll give you another great example is there's a movie called Fateful Findings by Neil Breen, which is worse than The Room. I can't even, just Google it, Fateful Findings. It's amazing. And the director really does think that I believe he is a born again, and he really believes that he is bringing light into the world. And when this movie, I hesitate to say came out, but you know, there was some four-wall distribution in Los Angeles. It played a Butnamathon against, well, I don't know if I should say this, but I don't, well, it all worked out in the end, but it played a Butnamathon, but we weren't supposed to publicize that. It was sort of an underground screening, let's say. But then when, in other words, he didn't know that it was playing a Butnamathon, you know? So, but then later it got out that people had seen it and people were, you know, enraptured with it because it's every bit as bug nuts as The Room. It's just unbearably bad and hilarious, and it has its own twisted philosophy that just makes no sense, and nothing works. Clearly the computer is off, but he's typing on it, and it's just ridiculous. But anyway, he went on a little bit of a tour, and you know, he did like Q&As with people who were clearly mocking him, and it does, you know, it is an ethical question. It's like when Wesley Willis became, I don't know if you guys know who this is, a recording artist in the 1990s.
Rock and Roll McDonald's.
All right. Of course you guys know who he is. I'm sorry. So Wesley Willis, you know, he had mental issues and people liked him because it was weird. But were they mocking him when they went to his concerts? Maybe a little. I don't know. It's a gray area. It's a gray area, but as long as, you know, he got paid at least. I don't think Neil Breen got anything. But and Breen is, you know, he puts his own money into his ridiculous projects, and you know,
I think the key here, if I'm making one last statement to Katie about why you can take bad movie recommendations and go out and prepare to enjoy yourself, is because the best bad movies, you're not laughing at them. You're not like, someone failed at this movie. You just are in awe of someone creating this in the first place, to have the audacity to not know what they're doing at all. And for it to be a vision, that's what Plan 9 is. That's Fateful Findings. That's The Room. Just like, in your own world, in your own universe, this art is coming out of you. And UA Boll, for all the shit that he takes, there are a few movies in his filmography that are like that. Some of them are
not as fun, though. Boll is not as fun as those other titles you mentioned. His stuff is just kind of dull. Uwe Boll, I say. It's just not, doesn't have the same. But the other thing, and I do agree with most of what you said, Patches, and I would implore Katie, it also has to be a social element, too. Like, you know, to go see, if you've never seen Plan 9 from Outer Space, you probably should, and see it with friends. You know, they show it at the Anthology Film Archives now and then. You know, go there and have a drink, and it really is quite fun. But, you know, there are people who just are obsessed with it. And, you know, there are blogs like Bad Movie a Night or Bad Movie Night, I think, is a website that I've run across periodically. It is something that I take in small doses. But, you know, which is why, to be honest, Mystery Science Theater, some of my favorite stuff on that show were the sketches in between the movies, you know. And
you and I are the complete opposite.
They're really funny. The sketches are funny. And like the zings. I mean, when you watch Mystery Science Theater, they're not just making fun of the movie. They're just telling jokes, period. You know, like they're just.
Yeah, based on what you're watching.
Yeah, but it's just
like empty beats.
Yeah, but they created, you know, it's not always about like, oh, we're making fun of, you know, how horrible this performer is. You know, they're just zinging, they're jazz riffing on the scenario to create jokes in a vacuum, and they're very clever guys.
I will say this about the new Mystery Science Theater 3000. I don't think I can talk about it much because of embargo stuff, but to what you're speaking about, Jordan, they create such a world within their own, like the fabric of the jokes that they can make in a given movie, that there are references to old jokes in old episodes.
Oh my God.
Made into new. If you're like a huge MST3K nerd, there are throwback jokes. That's crazy. I mean, but it speaks to what you're saying.
Cool. No, anyway. I like Mystery. I saw them live once when I was in college. They came to the Loeb Student Center, which doesn't exist anymore at NYU. It's been torn down. It was so disgusting. They torn it down. And they showed an old movie with Adam West. I don't even remember what it was. And the three of them sat in front of it and told jokes during the Adam West movie. And then we all got T-shirts.
It's a living. Katie, have we convinced you at all?
You know, I've never seen Prince of the City. There's so many good movies I haven't seen. The Great is better than The Godfather, I heard from Jordan Hoffman.
I didn't say that. I said it was on the same level. And I didn't mean it either, but I did say it.
Rock and roll music is the main weapon.
That does it for this week's Friday in the War Room. We'll be back next week. David will be back from his Passover Seder. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
Starting with Jordan.
Oh, hi. My name's Jordan Hoffman. I am a film critic, and you can follow me on Twitter at @jhoffman. And you can listen to my podcast, Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, which is found on StarTrek.com/podcasts.
And I am Matt Patches. I'm the executive editor of the entertainment section at Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, findinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes. You can share them with your friends and family who deserve to listen to this show. And you can leave comments. We'll probably read them out loud, as we did several other types of comments earlier this episode. findinginthewarroom.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. There I have pinned the most recent story I did for Patches, where I got to watch a whole bunch of old and international McDonald's commercials.
Yeah, that tweet you made was really weird. It didn't say what the article was about at all.
What the hell, man?
Criticize.
I'll do it later when we're back in real time tweeting area.
I just thought that there was a better tweet to make.
We're still recording, right? Still rolling.
Yeah.
Quick shout out to three very good movies in three good movies in limited release this week. Never mind. All right, we gotta go. All right, so long.
All right,
You'll never know what you are. Go to Jordan's Twitter to find out.
Follow me on Twitter at DA7E. Go to Facebook, fightinginthewarroom.com, or facebook.com/fightinginthewarroom to leave us messages also there where we interact with you, Facebook.
Oh, God. All right, goodbye.
Is it me? That's me.
It's you.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm at vanityfair.com and then sometimes sending to crying babies. I'm also on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRach. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where we'd love to hear from you, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which
What?
In honor of Fate of the Furious, what's your favorite movie where the stars secretly or not so secretly hated each other?
Thank you.
I already gave my answer.
You did. Yeah. Damn it. Shut up.
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. All right, I gotta go. Poor Michael has to have a show. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye.
Texas twisted tongue.